You're listening to The Drew Marshall Show, Canada's most listened to spiritual talkback program.
Well, currently touring with the classic rock band Boston. Most of you will recognize Michael from his days with the heavy metal band Stryper. It was 25 years ago. 25 years ago! Are you kidding me? That Stryper broke onto the scene with their debut EP, Yellow and Black Attack, and have since gone on to sell 8 million records worldwide and tour the world, spreading an inspirational message through their branded sound of rock songs, heavy guitars, and pristine harmony vocals. But I was blown away recently when I went to a Boston concert last summer up at Casinorama. And lo and behold, there in front of me was the man himself, Mr. Michael Sweet. Have a listen to a little more of Boston. Oh, man, I'm glad there's not a camera in the studio. Tim and I are doing the Wayne's World head bob here. MichaelSweet.com is the website. And joining us live is the one and only Ranger Mike. Or should we call you the Gipper? What do you think?
You know, these days I'm called the Gipper. I'm called Tigger. Ranger Mike has not been used in many years, but that's okay if you want to call me Ranger Mike. That's
Ranger,
fine.
How's the cranberry business going?
You know, I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. I could have told you back in 1996, '97, '98.
Uh-huh.
It's been a long time, man.
Well, first off, Michael, I got to say, I really think that you should do a duet sort of Cajun rock blues album with Ashley Cleveland.
Really?
Yeah, I think that'd be stellar.
Now, what made that come to mind?
The last time I had somebody on the show with a gravelly soul, rip your spinal cord out kind of voice was Ashley Cleveland. And having you on, I thought, yeah, that's a good blend. You two together would be sweet.
You think so? I've never thought of it. You know, something I have thought of many times is a duet, but not with Ashley Cleveland. But hey, you know, maybe that'll happen.
Maybe.
You never know.
Maybe. A resurgence of Stryper, first solo album in 5 years, and Boston. Dude, you got a lot of irons in the fire.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Yet at the same time, I keep referring to feeling like I'm in a fog, you know? And it's a lot going on, and yet at the same time, I can't seem to move forward. You know, I feel like I'm just in slow motion and trying to figure out how to live again, and it's just a really surreal, it's very surreal. It feels like I'm just kind of daydreaming, walking around, living, you know?
Yeah, and for those of you who may not be aware, the sad news is that Michael lost his wife just a few months ago to cancer.
Yeah,
and
March 5th, yep.
And so we got to start off by saying, like, we're sorry, man. That's just an absolute gut buster, and that explains the fog totally, I think.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the way I'm dealing with it, and I have a lot of people giving me their opinions, they mean well, dear friends and whatnot, telling me I need to do nothing for 6 months or, you know, do this and do that. And the way I'm dealing with it is I kind of grabbed the bull by the horns and made a phone call 3 days after the last service, and I booked a tour.
Okay.
That's the Stryper tour coming up September 11th. So that's how I'm handling it, is to keep busy and to keep moving. If I don't, you know, I feel like I'm going to fall into a hole, you know, and I don't want to do that. So that's, everybody handles it differently.
Yeah, and there's no rule book on grief, really.
There isn't. There really isn't. And, you know, I feel, I've also said this many times, so those listening hopefully won't roll their eyes. I sound like a broken record, but you know, I feel like my grieving started when we got the first phone call, the diagnosis, two plus years ago. That's when my grieving started. That's when my wife's grieving started, and we were grieving ever since. Yeah. And, you know, it was just a brutal, although we were hopeful and faithful and prayerful and believing in God that he could heal her, in the back of our minds, we knew how serious it was. We knew what the statistics said. We knew what the numbers said. And we were living in fear and living in grief, you know? So it's because of that, now that my wife has passed, she's with the Lord, I know she's restored, renewed, I'm going to be with her again, I feel like I can breathe. I feel like I can move forward. I feel like I can live.
Good for you. Good for you, man. You know, I wonder the dynamics of you now touring with Boston and, you know, the stuff that Tom has gone through and the rest of the band with the death of Brad Delp in March 07. You know, I just wonder if there's any kind of, I don't know, some kind of weird link there between what they have gone through as a band, what you've gone through as part of their band, losing your wife as well.
I don't think it's coincidental. I'm certain in my mind, without any doubt whatsoever, that God brought Tom and Kim in Boston into my life, into mine and Kyle's life, and the two of us into their lives. I mean, they've been instrumental in helping me to believe that God is there. Because, they, you know, there was a while when I felt like God wasn't there. I felt like for, you know, a few months after my wife's diagnosis that, why? Where are you, God, in this? What's going on? And I felt betrayed. My wife felt betrayed. And then, you know, this thing happened with Boston, and we got the phone call asking if I'd want to come and sing at the benefit. And it just felt to me like God was tapping me on my shoulder, saying, I'm still here. Because Boston, and it might sound strange, but, you know, Boston was such an influence of mine, and I looked up to them so much. Musically speaking, and they played such a role in my life, helping to shape my musical taste and preferences and how I go about doing things. To get a call and say, would you like to do this? It just blew me away.
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine how you must have felt. And when I saw you, I mean, this was last summer up at Casino Ram. I heard Boston was coming. And sometimes when the older bands come, you lower your expectations. I don't want to sound like an arrogant jerk, but you do. You lower your expectations. You go in, you just, you know, try to have a good trip down memory lane kind of a thing. But, dude, you guys came out, and my expectations were absolutely shattered. I mean, more so. And then here's this guy swing. He's got the big arm swings, the air swings, and the hair's going, and you're up in the monitor. I'm like, whoa, hold on a second. That's Michael Sweet. I had no idea you were traveling with these guys.
Well, it was one of those things that just doesn't happen in the real world. Not that way. You know, it's something that only happens in your dreams or in the movies, and it just doesn't happen in real life. And, you know, the plan was for Boston to do one last show, a benefit show, in August of 07. And that was going to be it. You know, they were going to call it quits. And I went up and met with Tom and Gary, and I walked in and we started going over songs, just guitars. And Tom just, you know, really liked what he heard and felt great about how it sounded and said it was the best they'd ever sounded as far as guitars go. And just, we all just, there was this spirit in this, you know, we clicked, best way to put it. We just clicked. It's just instantaneously. And then we did some rehearsals and I sang a few songs and they liked that. And, you know, I don't have a voice at all similar to Brad. I mean, my voice is totally different than Brad's. And I would never try to feel his shoes. It'd be impossible to. I can never feel his shoes or even come close. He was, like, in my opinion, one of the top five rock and roll vocalists of all time, possibly even one of the top three, one of the best of all time. Huge influence of mine, effortlessly, just brilliant. And here I am up there trying to sing these songs, and I thank God Tom allowed me to so graciously do my own thing, and put my own spin on the songs because I could not cop the songs note for note.
No.
We had the other guy, Tommy, who sounded more like Brad.
Yeah, now, well, hold on. Was he the YouTube guy?
He's the guy that had a MySpace, and he worked at Home Depot. And his daughter helped him put together a MySpace and of him singing Boston songs, demos. And Tom and Kim wound up hearing his voice around that time, going and listening to a song, and they were really impressed, thought he sounded like, a lot like Brad. They invited him out to the benefit. He came up and sang a song. And, you know, that was it. I mean, Tommy and I got the call. I was singing half of the material. He was singing the other half, and we went out and toured. And it was just a wonderful experience, and we had such a blast, and we're going to go do it again at some point, you know?
Well, listen, it came off. I mean, it went off amazingly, and it was really respectfully done or tactfully done, the way that Tommy kind of came out casually and then kind of went off stage and disappeared, and then you did a little bit. And it, you know, it wasn't like, hi, we're Boston, and we're here to totally forget about Brad Delp. No, there was a respect going on for each other and for the memory of Brad. I mean, it was just a good vibe.
Absolutely. And, you know, as long as everybody out there understands, it's not Boston continuing on trying to forget about Brad, as you put it, or trying to replace Brad.
No.
You can't do that.
No.
You can never replace Brad.
And I really hope, and I don't think Tom will do this, I hope you guys never replace Kim. My goodness. And that's
well,
all I'm
sure,
saying.
Hopefully Kim's listening and she's turning red right now. Because she is. She's a great, first and foremost, a wonderful person. Second, she's a wonderful musician. And, you know, third, she doesn't look half bad. Either.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, my wife busted me a couple of times. She gave me a smack on the arm and said, you know, pay attention to the right musicians here kind of thing. And anyway, Michael, the first time I saw you, I was a young punk working at a Christian camp down in California called Hume Lake.
Yeah.
And we had, I don't know, a bunch of people went down to some Jesus Fest, New Year's Eve concert, all the bands at Knott's Berry Farm.
Oh, yeah.
And you guys were up there, and, you know, I was such a good little Jesus boy that I rebelled against you guys. I'm not going over to see those striper demon worship guys. And so I then went over to the gun that squirts the water out and you hit a target and the thing goes up in the air and whoever gets up there first wins. Well, yeah, instead of going to see you guys because you were bad, I went over to this squirt gun deal and I had a bet with my buddy. I said, when she says go, we're both going to drill her in the head with the squirt water, you see? And he chickened out and I hit her dead in the eyeball and security came and I got chucked out.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
So you didn't get to see Striper, and you even if you didn't get chucked out, you wouldn't have seen Striper anyway because you didn't have any interest or desire to see Striper.
No, no, I was, it was me and Jimmy Swaggart, you know, we were.
You were holding up our albums, too, telling people not to go see Striper because we were wolves in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, I was trying to play them backwards just to see what I, you know, find some Satan-worshipping stuff in there, and I don't know. But seriously, like
let me tell you a little secret. I never listened to Striper either, so.
Get out of here. The negative press was just wild back in those early days, man. I mean, seriously, the Jesus people were all over. They were all up in your grill in a huge way.
They were. And, you know, interestingly enough, I came to know God through Jimmy Swagger. And that's how my brother started watching Jimmy on TV every Sunday. And then I sat in, and my sister, then my mom, then my dad, and we all wound up committing our lives to God through Jimmy Swaggart and then finding a church. And then here we are, you know, you fast forward a few years, and when we became Striper and started playing out, we've got Jimmy Swaggart holding up our record, speaking out against us. But, you know, we always tried to, it hurt a little bit, but we always tried to, you know, keep an open mind and just, you know, the old saying, kill them with kindness and love them. And that's what we tried to do with Jimmy, and we had some of his people come out to shows, and a lot of local churches over the years come out with bullhorns and protest Striper shows, and we'd always go out and offer him tickets and invite him in, you know.
You know, it's funny you should mention Jimmy Swaggart. I actually got a quote for him from him just for this show. We're going to play this quote right now. This is Jimmy Swaggart.
To try to make rock and roll a part of Christendom is blasphemous.
Top TV evangelist Jimmy Swaggart tells his audience of 8 million that all rock music is satanic.
It's almost like talking about Christian prostitutes, Christian pimps. Christian dope peddlers. It's the same thing. Christian rock and roll. You can't put the two together.
I'd like your opinion on that quote, Mr. Michael Sweet. That was Jimmy Swaggart talking about you, pretty much.
Well, I think it's interesting that he says Christian prostitutes. But, you know, aside from that,
You're bad.
You know, I think I understand what he's saying. I mean, to a degree, what I mean by that is, you know, if you're a prostitute or a pimp or, you know, in rock and roll and you haven't committed your life to God, then yeah, it's worldly. It's not, you know, you can't say it's Christian rock, but we were four guys that committed our lives to Christ. And, you know, we grew up in music. We grew up in rock and roll. We grew up on the streets of LA and we just continued on. We felt the calling to continue on, doing what we had always done, which was music, and just being a positive, you know, encouragement in the music industry instead of a negative, you know, a negative force, which there's plenty of that already. So, you know, you're always going to have people who feel you can't mix the two or you can't combine the two. But, you know, God created everything. I mean, he created music. He created everything. It's just when it's used, you know, for you know, bad purposes and, you know, for everything other than what God is and is all about, and that's when it's a problem. But, I mean, my gosh, I don't know. The only thing we can do is keep doing what we know we're supposed to do, and not everybody's going to agree. And that's what we've done for 25, 26 years.
Culture is very fluid. Language is fluid. Music is fluid. You know, I mean, I used to think Kiss was really heavy, and now I'm going back to Casinorama. I'm going to check their reunion kind of concert out. I don't think it's a reunion. I think they're still going. But now, you know, I've got Kiss on my iPod right beside James Taylor. You know, it's just...
Well, there you go. I mean, it's like... You know, that's between you and whatever you choose to listen to and whatever you, it's between you and God. I'm not one to point fingers and judge. I've been judged enough in my life.
That's your job though, Michael Sweet, to tell me that I should be deleting, you know, Knights in Satan's Service from my iPod.
It's really not my job. I'll tell you, you should be deleting if you haven't, do you have any Striper in your iPod?
Come on now. Come on.
If you do, you should be deleting that.
Can you tell us the story about that death metal concert in Holland? That was funny, man.
Funny?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, at the time, it was frightening. We thought we were going to die. We went, our agent, John Huey, booked us on this festival, and we just thought it was another festival in Holland. We flew over there, and, you know, drove to the... out in the middle of nowhere in the van and got out, and when we pulled up, I knew instantly, it was like deer in the headlights, I knew instantly there was going to be trouble, because when you see guys being carried off on stretchers, you know there's a problem.
Or you could be at a Benny Hinn crusade.
Or you could be at a Benny Hinn, but we knew this wasn't a Benny Hinn crusade.
Okay, all right.
So we got out of the van, and man, this was just a crazy crowd. Fights breaking out everywhere, you know, you could just sense it. It was just this really dark, nasty crowd, nasty spirit. And we went backstage, and we're unloading and getting ready, and we go backstage, and we're sitting back there getting ready and warming up on vocals and whatnot. We could hear the whole crowd chanting in unison. They were, you know, chanting this whatever it was. And we went out to the side of the stage to hear what they were saying, and they were chanting as a crowd about 12, 13, 14,000 people. You know, it rhymes with truck, striper.
Right, F-bomb, striper, got it.
F-bomb, striper, and they just kept chanting that. So that's when we knew, okay, this is going to be a fun show. And we cut honestly from the set immediately. And the ballads, they were gone. You know, we pulled those and we added all the heavy stuff. We went out and we just performed all the heavy material that we had. There was a cross being passed around, an upside down cross that was on fire with Robert's head on the body of a woman in a bikini.
Come on.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, these people wanted. I think if they had gotten a hold of us, I wouldn't be here talking on the phone with you today. It was that bad. They wanted to do us harm, no question about it. And we went out and we played. We were playing with Vengeance, Raven, at that time, all the hardcore, you know, black metal bands, you know. And we just went out and did it. We prayed, went out with no fear, and just started rocking, you know. And they were throwing everything at us, from bottles to fruit to vegetables to sandwiches to chains, all kinds of stuff, everything. And after three or four songs, I believe God's spirit won them over. I don't think it was us. I really don't. But you could sense the crowd and the spirit of the whole place starting to change. In other words, they went from flipping us off, the whole crowd, and screaming this incredibly vile, you know, language and throwing everything at us, to after two songs not screaming anything and all the fingers came down, to after four or five songs everyone was raising their hands in the air, and after six or seven songs the heads were in unison banging to Striper, you know. And God's spirit won them over, and by the end of the set the whole crowd was won over.
That's pretty amazing.
Honest to God, the hairs on my arms were on end. I mean, it was one of those moments. It was just, you had to see it to believe it.
I guess option B would have been just to throw a chicken in the crowd.
Yeah, absolutely. And after we played the set, we got off stage. We went back, we went off to the side where there was a tent with maybe 300-500 people to go do a meet and greet. And everyone said the same thing. Oh my God, we had no idea. We thought you guys were this wimpy band. We wanted to kill you, this wimpy Christian band, and we've heard you and we saw you perform, and we follow you now. We're fans, you know. My God, you guys were wonderful. I mean, it was unreal. It was incredible.
That's why I wanted you to tell the story. It's an amazing story. Well, the Striper gig has taken you all over the world, but you've also lived in a few different places. You lived in California and in Massachusetts. With both of those, I totally understand. But how the heck did you end up in Oklahoma?
My mom was born and raised in Oklahoma.
Okay.
And my dad, who worked for the railroad, Southern Pacific at the time, got transferred and relocated. So since my mom was from there and grew up there, he had like three or four options to be relocated to, and he chose Oklahoma. We went to Moore, Oklahoma, lived there for about a year and a half, and that was it. You know, real short period, but, you know, I've got roots there because my mom, my grandmother's from Oklahoma. Got family in Oklahoma still.
I saw a YouTube clip where I think, honestly, you stole the record from Billy Ray Cyrus as far as the length of the mullet goes.
What? Wait a second, I had a mullet?
Well, it was mullet-ish. It was mullet-ish because you had a kind of part of it pulled back like Steven Seagal into a bit of a bun in the back. And then
But you got to understand, if you had seen it, first of all, I never had a mullet. I had layers. a mullet is two different lengths. One short length and then one long length.
Yeah.
I had quite a few different lengths.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. I'll give you that one. Grew up in Whittier, is that right?
I was born in Whittier and grew up and moved a lot. We lived in Pasadena for a while. I lived in La Mirada, Fullerton, lived in Oklahoma, you know, did a lot of moving throughout my childhood.
La Mirada, boy, I haven't heard that. La Mirada, Flint Ridge. I had an ex-girlfriend that lived down there. Thanks for bringing that up.
Really?
I appreciate that.
Wow.
You began playing guitar at 5, singing at 12. Over the years, you picked up the drums, piano, bass. I think, did you not play bass for some competition you and your brothers won when you're...
I did. We were in a talent show. My dad used to play bass, and he had a Fender Jazz and a Bassman amp. And he figured, heck, why don't you play bass, you know, in this group? So we played Honky Tonk and Walk Don't Run. And I was in third grade, a talent show, and we won first place.
Nice.
Bass was bigger than me. I've got pictures somewhere. honest to God, it was bigger than me. I was a little, thin, skinny little kid, and this bass was huge, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you kept your weight off over the years, because, to be honest, the spandex thing and putting on the poundage, that would not be a good look. You know what I'm saying?
You don't like that look when guys put on old rockers from the 80s put on 100 pounds and they go back out in spandex. What's wrong with that?
No, no, there's just, I don't know. It's just something illegal should be about that. It's kind of like muffin tops, you know, they should be banned as well. Anyway,
I work hard on trying to stay in shape. I actually feel, I don't know if I look, but I feel like I'm in better shape than I was when I was, back in the day.
So. You look marvelous. You look marvelous. But somewhere along the line, picking up the drums, piano, and bass, you picked up a girl named Kyle from Buzzards Bay, I think.
I did, man. I met Kyle back in 1984, and she was a friend of Darren Hinton, who used to actually manage us. Darren invested money into us, and a wonderful friend and incredible inspiration in my life. And she introduced me to my wife, to Kyle.
Hmm.
Kyle came as a favor to do makeup. She was a makeup artist, very successful. Worked on films like Terminator, Teen Wolf, Wisdom, Ghost, just to name a few. And she came as a favor to do our makeup, and you know, it was one of those practically love at first sight kind of things. I mean, we saw each other and hugged at the end of the night and started dating, and you know, about a year and a half later, we wound up getting married.
How did Kyle go from child psychologist to makeup artist?
She was never a child psychologist. She has her degree, had her degree in child psychology, but never pursued that.
Okay.
She went out. She used to date and was engaged to Dave Amato, who plays right now for REO Speedwagon.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Dave's a great, great guy, great guitar player. Used to play for Ted Nugent, Cher, you know, just a veteran player. And she moved out to L.A. with Dave. Dave's from this area, too, Massachusetts. And they moved out there together to kind of start a new life and for him to pursue music. She wound up, you know, becoming very successful in the makeup field and doing that. And then meeting me. Her and Dave went their separate ways. I didn't move in on Kyle with her still dating Dave. They had broken up and were broken up for a couple of years.
Okay. All right. We'll believe you. How did you propose? I love hearing proposal. I'm a proposal story junkie. I don't know what's wrong with me. I should be writing country music.
It's really simple. There's not anything to it.
Okay.
I went to her apartment and I came to my senses. I basically put her through a lot for a couple of years, and you know, I've been hurt a number of times in my life, and I guarded my heart, you know, because of that. And whenever I would get serious with someone, I'd back off. And this happened with Kyle a number of times. We'd start to get real serious, and I'd say, I'm out of here, you know. And then I'd realize, what am I doing? This is a great, wonderful woman. I'd ask her out again. We'd start to get serious. I'd back off. This went on for about a year and a half. I finally came to my senses and realized, you know what, I'm going to lose her. And I was. She started dating a stuntman. She started becoming very serious with him. And I thought, my God, I'm losing her. And she's going to be gone forever. And what an incredibly wonderful woman. I don't want to lose her. So I went to her apartment. I asked her to marry me. We eloped. She said yes, of course. We eloped. It was just four of us at the wedding in Palos Verdes. And we got married.
She kicked the stuntman to the curb? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Buddy, that's
it. If you can believe that. And we married, and we were married for almost 23 years. This June would have been 23 years.
Well, you know, Michael, your honeymoon in Mexico must seem like a lifetime ago.
It does. It's unreal. I have video footage of that in Puerto Vallarta, and it was amazing. It does seem like a lifetime ago. Yet at the same time, it seems like yesterday.
Hmm.
I mean, I can't believe how my kids are 18 and 22. You know, they're grown, and it's just, life goes so quickly, and it's gone. You know, you open your eyes, and 22 years are gone. And that's why it's so important to seize every moment and every opportunity and live it to the fullest, you know, to live life to the fullest. And I feel like I threw away so many years, you know, of, you know, just being caught up in myself and in my work and not, you know, giving enough attention to my wife and my kids. And, you know, I can't get those times back, but I can do something about it now from this day forward, you know?
Michael, this is maybe somewhere you don't want to go, so shoot straight with me and tell me to back off. But I'm wondering if you would mind taking us, you know, back to February 11th, 2007. I think you and the family were maybe getting ready to celebrate your son's birthday, but something else kind of hijacked the rest of your life.
Yeah, we were getting ready to celebrate my son's birthday, and my wife Kyle at the time had been experiencing for about a year, experiencing some discomfort and bloating and just symptoms of menopause, basically. And that's what it was written off as. It was determined by her primary and diagnosed as menopause. So we just kind of ruled it out because it would get worse and get better, get worse and get better. Well, eventually, around December and January of 06 and 07, she started feeling worse and worse and getting bigger and bigger. And she was lying on the bed one night, February 9th, I think it was. And she lied back, and you could see clearly at this particular time, you could see, you know, an area on her left side that was raised much higher than any other area in her abdomen. And I just thought, and she thought, okay, this isn't right. There's something there. There's some sort of mass there. So we got in the car, and we went to emergency, and they did an ultrasound and said, yes, there is a mass. It's suspicious of ovarian cancer, but we don't know for certain. And she was transported the next day to Brigham and Women in Boston, and they did all the tests and everything and determined that it was a tumor and that she had multiple tumors and that it was ovarian cancer. They went in for debulking surgery February 14th of 07. And, you know, that was a six-hour extensive surgery, a complete hysterectomy. And that's when it began, you know. It was just from that time on, you know, it was just this nightmare. It's the only way to describe it, really. Just kind of walking around, and as I told you earlier, a fog, you know, just not really knowing what to think, and, you know, living with that extreme fear and being very fearful of the possibility and things to come, possibility of things to come, yet at the same time trying to live, you know, and trying to go on and be normal. And also within that, keep our faith.
That's a question I think many people have when they hear of others going through what you and your family went through. There must have been desperational prayers and, you know, almost side wagers made with God. You know, theology sometimes goes right out the window. But ultimately, you're crying out to this Creator to say, heal my wife. I don't want her to go. And did you ever get to a point where, you know, you hear these stories, the Jesus people pray their faces off for healing of a loved one, and they believe it's going to happen. They believe it's going to happen. And there's something that it's like Norman Vincent Peale sneaks in there, and this power of positive thinking takes over from the reality of Scripture. Did that ever happen to you?
Well, we just, from that day forward, we had our church come around us, constant prayer, people on the forums, Striper forums, and all over the internet, all over the world, churches praying for us, people praying for us. And we saw those prayers work. We saw those prayers come to life because we would see Kyle's numbers go from, you know, 6,000 or 6,500 down to, you know, 200 or 100 or 300. And we would see a treatment that the doctor said, I hate to tell you this, but this is probably not going to work. There's like a 2% chance it would work. And we would see that treatment work. You know, we experienced that. So we believe, and I still believe to this day, that those were prayers being answered because people were praying specifically for that treatment to work and for Kyle to get better. But for some reason, she would get sick again. And I also think, when I look back on it, Kyle was such a strong woman of faith, and I think God used her getting sick, getting better, getting sick, getting better. He used that to be an example to everyone around her and to see the kind of strength that she, you know, she had, strength she carried and the kind of strength that she showed.
So she was able to kind of be that woman who would, you know, I mean, the Lord gives, the Lord takes, blessed be the name of the Lord. That's a scripture that's driven me nuts for a lot of years because, you know, as a natural human, especially as a sucky male, when the Lord takes, I don't want to say blessed be the name of the Lord. When he gives, I'm all over it, but, you know.
Nobody wants to, but, you know, when you try to step back and look at the big picture, you know, you think about the time here on this earth, and it's just a small little fragment, just a little blur, little blink of eternity. You know, and when you think about that and where we're going as believers, we're going to be with the Lord in heaven for all eternity. And that's where she is now, and that's where I'm going someday. You know, you look at everything in a different way. You realize, okay, God knows what he's doing. You know, for whatever reason, he chose to, you know, take us through this journey, put us on this path, and we can either be, you know, terrible example to those around us or a great example of Christ to those around us. Kyle chose to be a great example, beyond a great example, like just an incredibly great example. Everyone that talked to her, everyone that saw her going through what she went through, she never complained. She never spoke about what she did in the past or who she was, which was just brilliant, you know, with a child psychology degree, a very successful makeup artist. She was very humble, very sacrificial. She gave all that up to love me and to raise our kids. And she never complained about anything. And everybody that saw that was blown away. And she God used her to transform lives, plain and simple. And if that's why she had to get sick and she changed lives along the way, well, then that's the answer, you know? Does it hurt that I don't have her? And am I lost? Yeah. Do I feel lost? Yeah. I just feel like I'm on my own now. I'm a single parent. You know, we always did everything together. We made all decisions together, and I'm on my own now. I'm going to be okay. I'm ready to move forward and be okay and live life and enjoy life, but, you know, still she's not here. And, there's a lot of things that I don't know. There's a lot of questions I have that are unanswered, but I know someday God will give me those answers. I know it, whether it's here on earth or in heaven, you know.
Michael Sweet on the phone with us, front man for Boston and Striper. And we're talking about Michael recently, very recently, losing his wife. Michael, Thursday, March 5th, I mean, that was just a few months ago.
Yeah, it was going on 3 months ago, this 5th of June. It'll be 3 months, and it was a short time ago, it was. And, you know, I've been, you know, like I said earlier, moving forward, you know, doing stuff in fast motion, and, you know, I'm getting, I'm going through the feelings of guilt, like, should I be? And then I stop and really think about it, and I feel like, yeah, I should be. I know Kyle, you know, I knew her better than anybody, obviously. And I know the type of person she was and is, and that is so sacrificial and wanting everyone to be happy and sacrificing her happiness for that. So I know she wants me to be happy. I know she wants me, I'm 45 years old, I know she wants me to continue on and try to enjoy life and live life to the fullest. So that's what I'm doing. And I got to be an example of my kids.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. This might be a bit of a crass question, but the reality is I wonder about this myself. If I didn't have my two kids, like you have your two kids, and, you know, your wife is now taken from you, and you and her were deeply in love with each other from what I can tell for sure, I mean, what's to stop you from saying, man, okay, I don't have kids. I just want to go be with her in heaven and just kind of ending it all?
Well, because I know she wouldn't want that first and foremost.
Okay.
I know she wouldn't want that. We never talked about that, but I know she wouldn't want it. Kyle was all about living life to the fullest and just, you know, taking each day by day and seeing what that day had to bring and being very excited about it. So she wouldn't be about like, well, I just want to go and end my life, you know, because of this or that.
Yeah.
Know it. Second of all, you know, that wouldn't be within God's plan. It just wouldn't be.
But Michael, you and I do stuff every day that's not really within God's plan. And so I'm just talking about the hardcore emotional reality of you and your wife being in just completely in love with each other. And then, I mean, just thinking back to that final day, you know, March 5th must have been hell on earth for you.
It was, you know, it was. And in a strange way, though, when Kyle took, she took three breaths, three last breaths, very deep breaths, and then that was it. And when she took that last breath, there was, in a strange way, and it's strange to say this, but it's true, there was almost like a peace that came over the room, and she was gone. And I knew it, and those that were there with me knew it. And to see instantaneously that she was no longer suffering, because she was suffering a lot in the end, and that she was instantaneously with the Lord and restored and renewed and in his presence, it blew me away. It blew me away. So it gave me peace. Feeling that peace and knowing that, you know, in an instant that she was no longer suffering and she was in heaven with God, it gave me peace. As weird as that might sound, the tough part was coming home and telling my kids and walking through the door in the house that we lived in for 14 years, not feeling like a home anymore. It still doesn't. I'm standing here in it right now looking out the window, and, you know, it doesn't. I thought about selling it. I thought about a number of things. I don't know what's going to happen. Life will tell. Time will tell. But, you know, it doesn't feel, without her, there's so many memories and everything, it just doesn't feel like home anymore.
How are the kids?
The kids are, believe it or not, they're doing okay. They're very strong kids. They're incredible kids. Kyle raised them and educated them. And, you know, as much as they've fallen into depression and, you know, gone into their rooms and cried their eyes out, and we've all done that, and we're all grieving, they're great kids, and they're strong kids. And they've been there for me. They've lifted me up. They live here. We all live here. My daughter's 18. My son's 22. And we're just hanging in there, you know, trying to lift each other up. We're all kind of, to some degree, going our separate ways. I mean, Lena's busy, off with her friends a lot, going to co-op, trying to finish school. And she and Kyle had decided that she would break her school up into, you know, do half of it this year and half next year. She's a senior in high school.
Right.
Homeschooled. My son, you know, he's got a band. I went in and asked him if he wanted to open the tour, him and his band. Right after Kyle passed, which blew him away. Are they ready to do it? I don't know. Probably not. But I don't regret one second of having asked him. I feel like it's given him purpose and motivation. And he's been practicing and writing, and they're recording and doing an EP, and he's been very busy with that. He's got a girlfriend. She's a sweetheart. They're very involved. And we're just all kind of doing our separate things, you know. We're rarely together, you know. We're here at night sleeping in the house together, and we see each other every day. But we all just kind of go about, like Lena just left. Mike's been gone all day. I'm going to leave in an hour or so myself. And, you know, that might be sad for some people to hear, but we love each other. We're there for each other, and we're just trying to figure it out, you know.
Good for you. Seriously, it's even in the midst of your mess, even in the midst of your fog, it's very obvious that you have a surrendered heart.
I'm trying. I really am. I try hard. I want people to somehow, always, in my whole life, from the time I committed my heart to God to now to until the day I die, whenever that may be, I want people to see me and say, you know, I see Christ in him. I see an example in him. Kyle wanted the same thing. She absolutely succeeded in doing that. She was incredible. I want to, if I could even just in a small way even come close to what she accomplished, then I'll be happy. But I want to continue living my life that way.
Okay.
And I do want to surrender to God, and I want his will to be done in my life, and whatever that is, there you go.
Well, thank you. I mean, thanks for spilling your guts. I mean, as we mentioned earlier, it's only been a few months, 3 months in a week or so here, and I'm not sure if you've done many interviews since Kyle has passed, but
I've only done a few. Okay. And I probably shared more with you than I have on the others, and you know, I'll probably share more and more as time goes on,
yeah.
Or maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I've got to share with everybody a couple, just one main thing. Kyle was 52, was she? Now, how old was she?
She would have been 52 this July.
Right.
So I'm going to be 46. She was she would have been 53. She's 7 years older than me.
Right, right. And may I just say that she looked like she was 33. That sounds like a suck-up, but, dude, that family picture you have on your website, I couldn't tell if you had three kids or two.
Oh, I know. She was blessed. Kyle was blessed with very, very, very nice skin, and, you know, she never looked her age, ever, ever. Everybody always thought I was older than her, and it used to kind of, get to me a little bit. I'd say, come on, man, you know, here I am 7 years younger than her, and she looks younger than me, and she did.
Yeah.
She did.
Well, and it looks like, again, I've not met your kids, but it looks like your daughter, just something about the photo that I saw, it looks like her demeanor is really taken after Kyle, and your son is kind of taken after you. He's kind of got that, I don't know, that one shot. He's kind of got that, oh yeah, what of it kind of look of, you know, in his face.
He's a lot like me, and my daughter's a lot like my wife, like Kyle.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Yeah. Bless you. I rarely say that. It's just an overused phrase, but man, I hope God blesses you in such a way that he freaks you right out.
Thank you, man. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, buddy.
Good to chat with you, Michael.
You too, man. And thanks for the time and having me on. I'm humbled, and I'm grateful. And it was great having the opportunity to talk to you and everyone listening, and I really appreciate it.
All right, mate. You take care.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Michael Sweet going out in the background with a little track he did for his wife. Have a listen.